Let's finish up the unit. Well, not today, but this week. This is the beginning of the final chapter in Unit 3, which is another chapter about a major process. In the last chapter, the major process was the complete oxidation of glucose. Now we're going to investigate photosynthesis. And in the opening slide here, we're not looking at any details of photosynthesis. We're just looking at some representative organisms capable of photosynthesis. Now, nearly all humans think of plants when they think of photosynthesis, and of course plants are very important photosynthesizers, but plants are only fairly recent photosynthetic organisms. They did not invent photosynthesis. Like nearly all important biochemical pathways, it was invented by prokaryotic organisms, bacteria, many, many hundreds of millions of years before plants even existed. So it's been on the scene for billions of years, actually. And that the fact that bacteria were the first photosynthetic organisms allowed for eukaryotic organisms to become photosynthetic endosymbiotically, as I was talking about when I described the origins of mitochondria and chloroplasts. They are really just, they began as engulfed bacteria to become those organelles. But you see, in addition to plants, there are algae, both unicellular and multicellular. Now, alga, the singular of algae, is kind of a catch-all term. Remember what I told you a protist is? A protist is any eukaryote that is not an animal or plant or a fungus. And some of those are not photosynthetic, some of those protists, but some of them are. So if you have a protist that is photosynthetic, that's what an alga is. And some of them are unicellular, like this one. Some of them are huge, bigger than trees, big brown algae living in oceans that are also photosynthetic. Plus you have, as I said, bacteria that are photosynthetic. Those are the ones that, those are the descendants of the bacteria that invented the process. So whatever the organism that's doing the photosynthesis, the important thing that's being accomplished here, chemically speaking, is that photosynthesis creates organic compounds using inorganic sources of carbon. And that, doing that, which is something only producers can do, is called carbon fixation. Carbon fixation is the incorporation of carbon from an inorganic source into organic compounds, which can then be used by organisms, including, of course, the photosynthesizers themselves. They're not making these organic compounds for us. They're making them for themselves, but we then eat them and use them for our own.
Carbon fixation, right?
Carbon fixation, correct. So even though there are many photosynthetic species, we're going to concentrate on plants in this chapter, but really, most of the details that we're going to learn for plants is actually true of other photosynthetic organisms. The big difference for prokaryotic or bacterial photosynthesis is that, of course, these organisms don't have chloroplasts, right? They don't have any membrane-bounded organelles. So what we're going to learn that is happening in a eukaryotic photosynthesizer in a chloroplast happens pretty much the same way in a prokaryotic photosynthetic organism, except it's using its only membrane it has, which is its plasma membrane that can be folded back and forth many times to accomplish the same things. But in slide two, we look at the basic anatomy of a plant. Now, there's a huge variety of plants, of course. Not all of them have the same morphology, but in a tree, for example, or in almost all plants, you have what are called leaves. Leaves in most plants are the chief photosynthetic organs of the organism. That's not true necessarily, but it often is. For instance, we live in a desert, and so it's common to see around us plants that have gone down a different evolutionary trajectory and have adapted their leaves not for photosynthesis but for protection. They turned into spines. But in most plants, the greenest part of the plant are the leaves. And no matter what, though, if any part of a plant that is green in appearance to us is capable of photosynthesis, it's just usually in the leaves. And when you look at a typical leaf, which is a flat shape, when you look at it in detail, like this little box, you can see that it's more or less a sandwich arrangement, where the two pieces of bread, so to speak, are two layers of epithelia, two layers of cells serving as coverings, top and bottom, and then sandwiched in between are many cells making up what is called the mesophyll layer. Meso means middle, and phyll means leaf, so it's pretty well named. It's the middle of the leaf, middle of the sandwich. And the mesophyll cells, which you're looking at one in detail below that, are where most of the chloroplasts are, which is why the leaves are green looking to us. Chlorophyll is the chief photosynthetic pigment. And we'll talk more about chlorophyll in a minute, but pigments are things that absorb light. That's a requirement for photosynthesis because light is the source of energy to drive the process. But that light has to be absorbed in order for the energy to be transferred to the plant for use. Now, how many chloroplasts there are within a cell varies, of course, but typically it's some number of tens. It could be 50 to 100 within one cell. We're looking at one chloroplast in detail here, which we've looked at before, remember, when we surveyed the organelles in the tour of the cell chapter, we talked about chloroplasts. And just like a mitochondrion, a chloroplast is multiply membrane bounded. So there's an outer membrane, which is just a smooth membrane big enough to cover the whole thing. There's an inner membrane, which is also fairly smooth. Now, technically, that's the other membrane. Technically, there are two, but we give three names to membranes here because this inner membrane then folds inward and becomes an elaborate-shaped folds that is all this green material here, green-looking material. That's really kind of an extension of the inner membrane. It's very similar to the situation you have where the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope folds outward and becomes the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, like we talked about. But we give it a different name when it's folded into these coin-looking things, and that is the thylakoid membrane. The green membrane is. Now these look like individual little coin-like sacs, but they're all really the same membrane and they share a common interior when you look at it in cutaway. So just like the multiply membrane-bounded mitochondrion has multiple compartments because of those multiple membranes, the same is true for a chloroplast. So they're is an intermembrane space in a chloroplast, just like in a mitochondrion, between outer and inner membrane. Then there is a space called the stroma, which is the compartment inside the inner membrane, but outside of all these green coins, which are called thylakoids. And then there's the space that's inside the coins, which is called the thylakoid space. Now, this word stroma you should be careful with because I forgot to mention earlier when we were up here on the leaf that the epidermal layers are pretty well sealed on a leaf, the top and bottom. They're kind of waterproof and gasproof, but they can't be entirely because there has to be gas exchange in order for photosynthesis to take place. CO2 has to get in because that's the input. That's the raw material that contains carbon in inorganic form that allows photosynthesis to produce the organic compounds, the sugars. And therefore, these layers, which are mostly sealed, have to be perforated, filled with little holes, in other words, called stomata. That's the plural, but the singular is stoma. So be careful with the word stoma and stroma, which are totally different things. All right? The stomata, by the way, or each stoma, is not really a structure. It's just a space. It's an opening. But it can be opened and closed by depending on the action of two cells on either side of it called guard cells. So the leaf can open up its stomata or close them down depending on need. All right, that's basic anatomy, and we're going to focus on the chloroplast because that's where photosynthesis takes place. In slide 3, you see a summary equation. Now, we already talked about a summary equation in the previous chapter, right? The summary equation for the complete oxidation of glucose. It's called a summary reaction because the complete oxidation of glucose is not a single reaction, right? But the summary reaction pretends that it is. In other words, it skips all the details in the middle and just lists what you start with and what you end with as though it actually occurs in one step. And in case you don't remember what that summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose is, well, it involves glucose as an input, so C6H12O6. Plus, you need 6 oxygens in order to go through the whole process. And that becomes 6 carbon dioxides, completely spent fuel, plus 6 waters. And then the non-material output is energy. Energy that's some of which is captured in the form of ATP, right? That's a summary reaction for complete oxidation of glucose. Well, in this chapter, we're studying the reciprocal process. Remember the reciprocal relationship I talked about? The reciprocal process, photosynthesis, therefore has a summary reaction that's the complete reverse of this. And this is written a little bit differently because it's written in rows, top and bottom. But if you read this from bottom to top, that would be the reverse, which is what I have written here. Except that water is listed twice, because water is both a reactant and a product. However, you start with 12 waters, you end up with 6, so you can simplify this whole summary reaction by subtracting 6 water from both sides. And that becomes 6 CO2 plus 6 waters on the left side become C6H12O6 plus 6O2, exactly the reverse of this. And it's also exactly the reverse with respect to energy, because to run the reverse photosynthesis, you have to supply energy. It doesn't come out, right? And energy that you have to supply is in the form of sunlight, or light of some sort. Naturally, it's sunlight, but you can use artificial light. Even though these are reciprocal processes, though, photosynthesis does not happen in steps that are the reverse of the complete oxidation of glucose. The starting point and ending point are opposites of each other, but how they get from there to how they get through the middle steps is different in the two processes. They're not actually the total reverse. So let's look at a summary. This is slide 4. And we looked at a similar summary before we started talking about the complete oxidation of glucose. A difference here is that, remember that complete oxidation of glucose has 2 major steps, glycolysis and cellular respiration, and those 2 major parts, I shouldn't say steps, parts, 2 major parts, those 2 major parts of the complete oxidation of glucose happen in different spaces. Right? Glycolysis happens in the cytosol. Cellular respiration happens in a mitochondrion. Well, in photosynthesis, it happens entirely within the dedicated organelle. There is no cytosolic part. That's why you see one chloroplast drawn here and there's nothing happening that's part of photosynthesis out in the cytosol. The entire thing happens within a chloroplast. But there are two major parts to photosynthesis, and those are both listed here. They've gone by different names throughout history. This book is using light reactions to name one of the parts and Calvin's cycle to name the other part. Now, old textbooks, which you're unlikely to go back and ever read, but if you were to check old textbooks, I'm talking about many decades ago, these two parts would be called the light reactions and the dark reactions. That started being out of favor because linguistically, if you call something the dark reactions, it implies that darkness is required, when that's actually not true. So long ago, we stopped using light reactions and dark reactions for names of the two parts of photosynthesis, and we replaced them with the more descriptive names, light dependent reactions, I'm sorry, which is what this book should have used, really. That's the better word. Light-dependent reactions is part one. And then instead of calling the dark reactions, we call them the light-independent reactions, which means it can happen whether there's light or not. But the most important thing that happens in the light-independent reactions is a biochemical pathway called the Calvin cycle. So light-independent reactions and Calvin cycle can be used interchangeably. They mean the same thing. Just like Krebs cycle can be called citric acid cycle and so on. All right, those are the two major parts of photosynthesis. If you want to think about this in terms of goals, like we did for the complete oxidation of glucose, the goal is to produce organic compounds. And those organic compounds are in the form of sugars. Notice that the sugars produced in photosynthesis are produced in the second part, in the light-independent reactions, in the Calvin cycle, in other words. That's where carbon fixation, the really important thing that happens in photosynthesis that only producers are capable of, which is why all of us consumers rely on producers, that happens in the second part, and we can tell that it's carbon fixation because an input is CO2, which is inorganic, right? Even though it's carbon-containing, it's considered inorganic. And out pops sugar, which is organic. The photosynthetic organism, plant or otherwise, producing the sugar is not only feeding itself. We've already talked about sugars being important fuels, right? So that's one benefit of photosynthesis, but that's by far not the only reason a photosynthetic organism is producing sugars. Yes, some of those sugars are going to be used as fuel. So just like we eat things that contain sugar in order to extract energy out of them via complete oxidation of glucose to produce ATP, the plant or other photosynthetic organism can do the same thing with the fuel that it produces itself. But importantly, once you have sugars, which are organic, then you can use those organic compounds and rearrange them various ways to make other organic compounds, the other organic macromolecules that we talked about, right? You can make amino acids and things like that that could be built up into polypeptides and so on. So this is something that we consumers cannot do at all. We have to have our organic compounds already in we have to take in carbon already in organic form in order to be able to use it for anything. Now, we don't keep it in the same form. You know, whatever we eat is organic compounds, no matter whatever organism you eat, you're taking in organic compounds. We rearrange those into our own organic compounds. But if we just took in CO2, we wouldn't be able to do that. It would be useless to us. And similarly, when a photosynthetic organism once it already makes sugars, then it can do its own rearranging and use it for other things besides as fuel. So also in the thinking about this in terms of goals, producing organic compounds, sugars, out of CO2 as a carbon source, how would you describe that process energetically? What word would you use? We talked about a lot of different words having to do with energy, right? What would you expect that process to be? Well, what about metabolically? What would you expect it to be? What word would you use to describe it metabolically? Making a complex sugar, a relatively complex molecule, a sugar, out of a very simple molecule, CO2. What would you describe that as? Well, both, actually, as we'll see. But you're actually looking at finer detail than what I'm trying to get at. If you're taking a small, simple molecule and producing large, complex molecule, larger, more complex molecule, what would you qualify that as? That is an anabolic process, right? Anabolism. This is two chapters ago, so you're showing me that you're not getting close to being ready for this difficult exam. You have to take chunks of this every night and learn it. That would be anabolic. And therefore, what's the corresponding word that has to do with energy?
Catabolic.
No, anabolic, because we're building it up. The complete oxidation of glucose is catabolic, because you're breaking down a molecule. Yeah, and means up. Cat means down. So you're building up. Yes, endergonic process, anabolic process go hand in hand. So the Calvin cycle, the production of the sugar out of inorganic carbon, is endergonic. That means this is also non-spontaneous, right? It's never going to happen on its own. You have to force it to happen by supplying energy from outside the process. Well, energy is coming in, of course, right, as light. We've already talked about that. But, importantly, a plant does not have, or any photosynthetic organism, does not have the ability to directly use light energy to drive the endergonic process of carbon fixation that occurs when carbon dioxide is used as a carbon source to build sugar. Compare this to the reciprocal relationship, the reciprocal process of the last unit, the complete oxidation of glucose. When we talked about ATP as the energy currency, right? I told you that cells don't have the ability to use the energy that's directly released from breaking down a fuel to drive the endergonic process that it's forcing to happen. There has to be an energetic middleman, right? Which is what ATP is, an energy-carrying molecule. So we break down our fuels, we oxidize our fuels to release energy, some of which gets captured to build ATP, to store that energy temporarily. And then ATP gets broken down to release energy, and that's what drives the endergonic process. Very similar thing is happening here. The endergonic process here is the production of sugar via carbon fixation in the Calvin cycle, the light-independent reactions. That has to have energy, but the energy doesn't come directly from light. The energy comes directly from ATP, but also another important energy-carrying molecule called NADPH. We've talked already about NADH, right? Important energy carrying molecule in the previous unit. One of these taxis. Well, this is another fleet of taxis that specialize just in photosynthesis. So a plant has NADH and NAD. That's important in the mitochondria that the plant has. But it also has dedicated taxis just for photosynthesis that are NADP instead of just NAD. So it's nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide with a phosphate on it, NADP. And just like NAD exists in either of two forms, oxidized and reduced, right? Empty taxis, full taxis. Which one is the empty taxi? Well, I mean, which version, as far as oxidation is concerned, is the empty taxi? Yes. Which is high energy or low energy? The oxidized form.
Wouldn't that be high energy because then it can take two electrons? Or?
No, it's low energy because those electrons are the energy. Okay, so just like NAD exists as oxidized NAD plus, or that's low energy, or high energy reduced form, NADH and H plus, here we have a different company of taxis doing the same thing, but with a phosphate involved, and it goes back and forth between low energy form called NADP plus, and high energy reduced form, which is NADPH and H plus. Okay? Well, both of these molecules, ATP and NADPH, are carrying energy. And they are both required for the Calvin cycle to produce sugar, to drive that endergonic anabolic process of producing sugar. Requires not only energy, but specifically energy in these two forms. And not either or. It needs both of them. Or it won't happen. So it's not sunlight that directly drives the Calvin cycle. It's ATP and NADPH. All right? Well, where does this come from? Where does ATP and NADPH come from? The first part of photosynthesis. That's why the first part is required. The first part is all about transforming light energy, or transducing it, light energy, into energy in the forms of ATP and NADPH. So these are the two different energetic middlemen that then deliver the energy that was in light to the second part of photosynthesis to drive this endergonic process and produce the sugar. When the Calvin cycle uses the energy of ATP and NADPH, what happens should be familiar to you already. ATP getting spent means getting dephosphorylated. So the ATP, when it delivers its energy, gets turned into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. The reduced form of this coenzyme, NADPH, and H+, even though it's not listed that way, when it delivers its energy, that means it gets reoxidized into the lower energy, the empty taxi, NADP+. So these top ones are now lower energy. Well, they need to go back then to the light reactions and pick up more energy from light. And ADP, an inorganic phosphate, will get turned back into ATP. NADP plus, the reduced coenzyme, I mean the oxidized coenzyme, sorry, will get re-reduced into NADPH. And so that's why this is a cycle shown for these energy-carrying molecules occurring between the two parts of photosynthesis. They're energy shuttles, both of these molecules, ATP and NADPH. Let's think about it in terms of inputs and outputs for both of these parts. For the light-dependent reactions, the material input is water, which makes sense when you think about the reciprocal relationship, because water was an output of the reciprocal process, right? Complete oxidation of glucose produces water. Photosynthesis requires it. It also makes sense because of what water is used for in photosynthesis. The water in photosynthesis is not about watering the plant and keeping it osmotically turgid. That's important as well. We're talking about a totally different use of water here. It's not really the entire water that's required. It's the hydrogens of the water, and specifically the electrons and protons of the hydrogen. So water serves as a hydrogen source, and therefore what's left when you take those hydrogens away is oxygen. Oxygen is an output of photosynthesis, just like it's an input into the reverse process. Also think about what hydrogen did when we picked it off of the fuels in the reverse process. We pick our fuels of hydrogen, put them in taxis, and then eventually undergo electron transport for the sake of producing ATP, right? That's what the light reactions do with, we're not seeing the detail yet, but with the hydrogen that gets stripped from water, electrons and protons make electron transport work with the pumping of those protons and the transport of the electrons to produce ATP, just like in the previous chapter. And the hydrogens end up in taxis in the form of NADPH. So the H that's in NADPH that powers the Calvin cycle, that used to be in water. All right. Well, none of this can happen, the light-dependent reactions, unless you have an input of light. And that's why they're the light-dependent reactions. When the light is not present at night, or when you turn off the light, then it will stop. Now let's talk more about light, slide 5. I covered this a little bit in lab, just as an introduction. But light is electromagnetic radiation. That's the form of energy that light is an example of. We use the word light differently. Some people use light just to mean all electromagnetic radiation. In other words, there's visible light and there's invisible light. Others use the word light just to refer to only electromagnetic radiation that is visible to humans. And you can see that here. This visible portion, this visible light, is really just a tiny sliver of the overall electromagnetic spectrum. All of this stuff up here is light. It's just that most of it is invisible to us. It's the same stuff, though. Electromagnetic radiation, which means there's an electrical component and a magnetic component. We're not going to get into the physics of that, but that's the nature of it. That's why it's called electromagnetic radiation. And there's a duality of nature to it, which is also beyond the scope of this course, but just believe me that light has a duality to it, meaning that in some ways it acts as a wave, and some ways it acts as a particle. If we think about it as waves, as I said in lab, then you can talk about a wavelength, which is the distance between any two repeating parts of the pattern. You can measure it anywhere you want as long as you measure it to the next place. It's always going to be the same distance for a given wave. And wavelength is a distance, a length. Okay? Shorter wavelength light, like this one compared to the one above it, notice that distance is less than this. Shorter wavelength light has higher energy. And so the shorter wavelengths on the left end of this spectrum is more and more energetic light, and therefore more and more dangerous. Now, gamma rays would kill us, but thankfully they're filtered out and don't reach the surface of the Earth. They're out there, but that's one of the dangers of space, for instance. X-rays, a little bit longer wavelength. Dangerous, though, still causes cancer, right? Form of skin cancer. I mean, X-rays can cause, X-rays medically can cause cancer, right? Which is why they limit the number of exposures you have. A little less dangerous, but still dangerous, is UV, ultraviolet light. That causes cancer, skin cancer, which is why you should minimize your exposure to sunlight. But all of that stuff is still invisible. Ultraviolet gets its name because the wavelength of light that is the shortest, but that we can see, or that causes vision in us, is violet light. And therefore, above that is ultraviolet. Ultraviolet literally means above violet. That is the high energy end of the visible light, violet. We tend to think of red as being hot and blue as cold, but the blue end is actually the higher energy end of the visible spectrum. But when you're in this visible spectrum, this tiny sliver, that's where you have red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, red in reverse here. Now, this stuff is not any different from X-rays, gamma rays, or ultraviolet light. The only thing that's different is the wavelength. But in order for our eyes to work, the light has to be the right wavelength in order for it to interact with the pigments in our eyes' retinas. And so the light doesn't have any color, whatever the wavelength is. Color is a sensation. It's an event happening in our brains as a result of light interacting with the pigments in our eyes. That's why it's just easier to say the light is colored, but it's really not. Nothing is colored. Anyway, when you get to red, that's as long a wavelength as we can sense, and therefore longer than that is called infrared, below red. Longer than that is microwaves, which is continuously going through our bodies all the time. We just can't see them, which are what your cell phones operate on, and your microwaves, the ovens. Even longer than that are radio waves, which are continuously going through us as well. It's all the same stuff. Well, we're in the middle of a chapter about photosynthesis, as in plants, for instance. So why does it matter whether something is humanly visible or not? Humans are not photosynthetic organisms. Well, it's not just an accident. It's because of similar evolution that the pigments that photosynthetic organisms use that absorb light in about the same range as human eyes absorb light with their other different pigments. And so this visible range is not just something we can talk about as fellow humans, but it also happens to be the range that's important for plants. Then let's look at 6. Once again, an object doesn't have color. Color is a sensation in our brains. But it's typical for us to say that a plant is green, even though it's not. What makes it look green to us is that when you shine white light on it, which is the combination of all wavelengths and therefore all possible colors, only some of those photons, a photon is what we use to describe the particle nature of light. A photon is one particle of light. It doesn't have any mass like an electron or a proton does, but it's one discrete particle of energy, light energy. Anyway, only some of those photons get absorbed by the plant, by the pigments. Now, that absorption is required, because if it didn't get absorbed, then there wouldn't be light energy, there wouldn't be energy input into the light-dependent reactions, and photosynthesis would be impossible. But what we can see here is that the pigments of photosynthesis don't do a very good job of absorbing light with wavelengths that look green to us. The other wavelengths do get absorbed. And therefore, when you shine white light on this plant, those other wavelengths that would look other colors to us don't reach our eyes because they get absorbed by the plant. And the only ones that don't get absorbed and therefore that get reflected to our eyeballs are the green wavelengths. And that's why it ends up looking green to us. This also, though, tells you that if you're interested in allowing this plant to do well artificially with light, like in a closet, for instance, you wouldn't want to give it green, nothing but green light. That would be like starving it, basically, because the green light is not going to be absorbed. It's not going to photosynthesize. Yeah, grow lights have, there are rich on the other ends, the reds and the blues, but not in the middle. Sunlight has it all, and the green just comes to us, to our eyes. We can see more of that in slide 7, actually. There's three different ways of showing the same thing in this slide, really. On the top, we have three absorption spectra. That's the plural of spectrum. Each of these individual curves here in this top graph is its own absorption spectrum. And an absorption spectrum is a graph of absorption of light on the y-axis versus wavelength of light, corresponding to color in us. And what you see is that none of these three major categories of pigments, one for each trace here, does a very good job of absorbing light in the green range. They both have they all have peaks, though, in the red and blue ranges, which I just talked about in the previous slide. And that's why those wavelengths of light are good for the plant in terms of driving photosynthesis, because that light gets absorbed. The other thing that we see in the trace, since there's three of them, is that chlorophyll, which means linguistically green leaf, chloro means green, like in chlorine, a green gas, and I told you already that phyll means leaf, but chlorophyll is a pigment, and it's the major pigment for photosynthesis. It does most of the absorbing, but chlorophyll itself comes in two forms, A and B. So they're different, very slightly different molecularly, as we'll see in a minute, but because they're at least slightly different, they have different absorption spectra. And there's also a third category called carotenoids. Well, actually, a third category as a catch-all would be called accessory pigments, that are pigments also important for absorbing light for photosynthesis, but they collectively are things other than chlorophyll. So there's various accessory pigments, but the major accessory pigment in plants is carotenoids. And by having all of these categories, a combination of all of them, that means that the true response is really the sum of all these peaks and valleys. And you can see that reflected in what's called an action spectrum below. For an action spectrum, you generate this trace by measuring rates of photosynthesis, which you can measure by detecting the oxygen that's produced. And you do that versus wavelength of light. What you see here is that in the green range, there's not nearly as much O2 produced because there's not nearly as much photosynthesis on the part of the plant that's receiving green light. But there's major peaks at red and blue. And still, the same thing is shown in C. This experiment on the bottom was done on a glass microscope slide, but in a sealed chamber, so it's not exposed to air. And what they used here is a filamentous alga. So this is a photosynthetic protist, several different cells end to end. That's one organism. Plus they have aerobic bacteria that require oxygen to live, just like we do, because they can undergo aerobic respiration. And since it's sealed, there's no oxygen that's getting in there from the air. The only source of oxygen is the oxygen that the plant is producing as a byproduct of photosynthesis, not the plant, the alga. What you see is the bacteria build up in the blue and the red because there's plenty of oxygen being evolved there because of photosynthesis, whereas the green range isn't producing any. Okay, so green is not useful light for a plant. Well, the structure of chlorophyll, both A and B, is shown in slide 8. And here you can see the minor difference between chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. So they're almost exactly the same molecular structure, except that in chlorophyll A, this one little functional group, as in this whole molecule, is a CH3, a methyl, whereas in chlorophyll B, it's CHO instead. All the rest of this is the same in both. That small difference, though, makes the absorption spectra different, and therefore having both of them gives you an even better response to more colors of light if you're a plant. Now, chlorophyll is a pigment, and pigments, by definition of being pigments, are particles that absorb photons. And this is why they look colored to us. That's why we, you know, in art we use pigments to make the painting or the artwork various colors. That's because, I mean, the reason they look those colors to us is the same reason plants look green to us. Pigments are absorbing various photons, and the other photons are coming back to our eyes. This is really important to be a pigment in photosynthesis, though, because you have to have something to absorb the light. Otherwise, you don't get the energy from the light. Well, there are two major functional ends to this chlorophyll molecule, corresponding to the green shaded part and the rest of it that's not shaded green. In terms of absorption, the business end of the molecule is the green shaded part. This is where photons, if they happen to be the right ranges of wavelengths, can be absorbed. So you can, if you think about this as, think of this molecule as kind of as an antenna receiving light of various wavelengths, just like radio waves do. Radio waves are light. Then this is where that happens, in the green shaded part. But that's not the only part of the molecule. There's all the rest of this. And just below the green shaded part, we see a bunch of atoms explicitly labeled with their symbols. But then starting here and the rest down, there's no atoms being shown, but there's still atoms. In biochemistry, in organic chemistry specifically, there's a whole bunch of carbons and hydrogens. There's also oxygens and other things, of course. But there's so many carbons and hydrogens that they eventually got sick of drawing them over and over. And so they devised a shorthand method of drawing structural formulae. Every time you have a corner not labeled with something else, like if this were an O, then that would, of course, be an oxygen. But when you see a corner that is unlabeled, that's just shorthand for an assumed carbon. And also, you know that carbon has a valence of 4. Well, this corner has 2 bonds that are showing, but that carbon here at the corner needs to make 4 bonds, so you also have to imagine, just infer that there are 2 implied hydrogens there as well. So this is just very shorthand way of looking at that. Anyway, from here downward, all you have are carbons and hydrogens. All right. Well, what does that make this portion of the chlorophyll molecule? If that were a molecule by itself, how would you describe it? Just below my hand, if that were a complete molecule, what word would you use to categorize it? A what?
A hydrocarbon.
A hydrocarbon, exactly. And what other things are almost hydrocarbons that we learned about in this course? Hydrocarbons are hydrophobic, but when you think of the macromolecules chapter, what sorts of molecules that we looked at are technically not fully hydrocarbons, but most of the structure is hydrocarbon? What specific part of a fat? Fatty acids. except for that one end that it's a carboxyl, the rest of a fatty acid is hydrocarbon tail, right? Now, fats is one thing that has fatty acids in them, but what other important molecule has fatty acids in them? Molecule that every cell that's ever existed has in it. Well, it's true that nucleic acids... Well, actually, it's not even true that all cells have nucleic acids, but all cells are cells because of what structure? What structure defines the cell?
Lipid bilayer, right?
Yes, the phospholipid bilayer. Phospholipids have fatty acid tails, right? Hydrocarbon tails of the fatty acids on the two tails. And that's what makes up membrane. Whether it's the plasma membrane or a membrane of any membrane-bounded organelle like a chloroplast. Well, these pigment molecules, chlorophylls, are embedded in membrane, specifically in the thylakoid membrane of the chloroplast. So having this long hydrocarbon tail as part of the chlorophyll molecule, even though it doesn't do anything for absorbing the light, is truly important because this part keeps it embedded in the phospholipid bilayer of the thylakoid membrane. This part is just as nonpolar and therefore hydrophobic as the tails of the phospholipid making up the membrane. So that's what keeps it embedded in the membrane. This part is all about receiving the light. That brings us to 9. Now, a photon, as I said before, is a single particle-like unit of light. It's one little packet of energy. And if a photon encounters an object, like I was talking about in lab, there's three basic possibilities, right? It can just pass right through. It can be transmitted. It can be reflected. It'll bounce off. And in either of those two possibilities, the photon is still there. It's either just continuing on in the same direction, or it's bounced off in another direction, but it's still there. The third major possibility, though, is that the photon gets absorbed by that particle. And if a photon does get absorbed, that photon no longer exists. That little packet of energy no longer exists as a photon. But what do you know about the first law of thermodynamics? What does that tell you? Right, energy can't be destroyed. So when the photon is destroyed, that doesn't mean the energy that it was containing gets destroyed. The energy has to go somewhere. Well, the particle that absorbs the photon receives the energy. That photon no longer exists, though. And when that happens, the pigment, that's what we're saying is the particle that's receiving this photon, that's absorbing it, that pigment gets excited. What excitation means in this case is that one of its electrons moves up an energy level at least one energy level. It could be more than one. But think about what we talked about already as energy levels or shells. Those are distances from the nucleus, right? And the closest one to the nucleus is the lowest energy level. If an electron is there already and it gets excited, it's now in a higher energy level, farther away from the nucleus. Well, it takes energy to move an electron to a higher energy level, and that energy used to be in the photon. So no energy is destroyed here. It doesn't violate the first law. But the photon is gone, and now the energy that was in the photon is in the form of an excited pigment molecule. That's a very, very unstable situation. High G, remember, high energy, corresponds to instability, which is why thermodynamic systems tend to go, if they can, to a lower G value. What it means in this case is that this excited electron would like to go back to a lower energy level if there's space for it. Remember, some electrons have to be in a higher energy level because there's no room in the lower energy levels. But if there is room, and this one just was lower before it got excited, it wants to go back. Very unstable situation. So what will happen in ordinary cases is that the excited electron, the E minus is the electron, will immediately go back to the lower energy state it started at, energy level. Well, that represents a decrease in G. So the electron is losing energy. Just like the electrons pass through the electron transport chains are losing energy because they're getting closer and closer to a nucleus. Once again, a loss of energy can't mean destruction of energy. No energy gets destroyed when the electron goes back down to its previous energy level. And therefore, in order for energy not to be destroyed, in a sense, in order to make sure the law gets obeyed, a brand new photon, not the photon that came in originally, that's gone, a brand new photon gets created when the energy, when the electron goes back down to a lower energy level. That release of energy from the electron gets released from the pigment as a brand new packet of energy in the form of light, a brand new photon. And then that photon moves at the speed of the light away from that pigment, maybe to our eyes, for instance. Well, this is called fluorescence. Here's the word. Fluorescent materials work this way. They absorb light, which excites their atoms. The excitation lasts just a tiny, tiny fraction of a second. But then they fluoresce because the excited electrons go right back down to the unexcited state. And that creates brand new light that shines from that object. This happens with fluorescent paint. For instance, if you get away from the city at night, so there's no street lights, but there are speed limit signs, well, those are not reflective signs. Those are painted with fluorescent paint, which means, and that's why they look very bright. They look like they're creating their own light. They're so bright at night. Well, they are creating their own light because they're fluorescing. The light of the headlights excites the atoms in that paint. The headlight light is gone. Those photons get destroyed, but they excite the paint atoms, and those excited electrons immediately go back down to the unexcited level, creating brand new photons of light, which then reach our eyes. Just like a turned on light is bright, a fluorescent sign is bright. And that's what happens normally with pigments. They fluoresce. But if you think about this in terms of goals of photosynthesis, that would be a total waste of energy, right? A plant would never want fluorescence to occur. Because if you go to the trouble of having these chlorophyll molecules to absorb light and you simply fluoresce, you're not capturing any of that light for the use of the second part of photosynthesis, which is to drive the production of the sugar. All you would be doing is being very bright looking to humans and other organisms with vision. Total waste of energy. Nevertheless, if you take chlorophyll molecules, trillions and trillions of chlorophyll molecules in solution, which is what you have in this flask, and you shine light on them, like the same light that shines on a plant, it will fluoresce and it will look very bright to us. By the way, you shine white light on it, but it does not fluoresce white. Anyone know why? The answer is shown in the cartoon if you want a hint. Exactly. You can't do anything about the second law of thermodynamics. So when the electron goes back down in energy, some of that energy is wasted as heat, and therefore the brand new photon that gets created has to be a longer wavelength, lower energy, than the original photon, so it changes color to us. Okay, so fluorescence does happen with chlorophyll in solution, but that would be entirely a waste of light energy for a plant. And not surprisingly, plants don't fluoresce because of their special arrangement that they have with their chlorophyll molecules, which is shown in slide 10. What we have here is a cross-sectional view of this. Looks like a purple bell pepper cut in half. But this whole thing, this whole bell pepper-looking purple thing and the blue center, is one of billions of copies of what we call a photosystem. A photosystem includes pigment molecules, but in a special arrangement with proteins. So this whole thing is one photosystem, but one photosystem consists of two major components. In the middle, which is why we're looking at it in cutaway view, you wouldn't see this blue part otherwise. At the core is what's called a reaction center complex. And the reaction center complex is proteins of various kinds, but also you have a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules in there. The other major part of the same photosystem are several light harvesting complexes. Each of these purple lobes, and they would go all the way around the core, are light harvesting complexes. And those also are proteins, but proteins that are holding in place in a special arrangement many, many copies of chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, and accessory pigments as well. Only chlorophyll A is shown here, but all those pigments that were part of that graph that we showed are in here. And this particular way in which these chlorophyll molecules are held in relationship to each other is very important. This is what prevents fluorescence. Fluorescence would be totally wasteful to the plant. It wouldn't allow for any useful energy to be absorbed. It would just be shown away as fluoresced light.
I'm curious, so, because it seems like since fluorescence gives off heat, right?
Gives heat and light.
Yeah, it gives heat and light. Is that how solar panels work? Like you get the heat or something from the sunlight? Or?
Yes, there's going to be definitely wasted heat in any solar panel.
Like, is that like what they're doing? Is that they're getting the heat from that for energy, or is it something?
No. The heat is just waste.
Okay.
As is, you know, only when a photon strikes on the right part of it. So just like in a plant, there are trillions and trillions of photons that just don't hit in the right place, and they therefore are wasted. Okay. Similarly on a solar panel. But a lot of those photons do hit in the right place. They cease to exist, and they cause electrical current.
Okay, but that is still fluorescence.
It's not fluorescence because it's not producing visible light. Otherwise, those panels would shine bright to us. They would look like they're light panels. Yeah.
There are fluorescent animals, right?
Right.
So is it also like a light complex they have within their bodies?
Exactly right. Yes, like fireflies or lightning bugs. Depends on where you were born is what you call them. They are producing light.
Do they also give off a lot of heat? Like, will their metabolism work harder because of the heat?
Well, yes, some of it is definitely going to be heat. But if they were using all that energy and producing no visible light, it would be a hell of a lot more heat. Because the light is also energy. The heat is energy, the light is energy. Okay, now, in a photosystem, unlike a solution of just chlorophyll molecules, in a photosystem there isn't fluorescence. It's prevented because of the particular way that these chlorophyll molecules are held in relation to each other by the protein complexes. But there is excitation that happens, of course. They're pigment molecules, so they still absorb photons. The photon is coming in as the yellow squiggled arrow. Now, it doesn't matter which of these chlorophylls in a light harvesting complex gets hit. It doesn't have to be this one. That's just the one the cartoon is using. But a photon comes in and strikes some pigment. That pigment molecule, that, let's say it's a chlorophyll because it most likely is, that chlorophyll gets excited directly because of the destruction of that photon, the delivery of that energy to excite an electron. Now, it would fluoresce, but if there is another pigment molecule, the correct distance from it, very close, I'm talking about nanometers from each other, nanometers are the sizes of atoms, then instead of fluorescing, this excited pigment, this first chlorophyll, will send its excitation to its neighbor, to another chlorophyll right beside it, without producing a photon. If it produced a photon, that would be fluorescence, that would be wasteful. But instead, if you have another pigment right beside you and you get excited, you can excite the next one and become unexcited yourself. And that doesn't involve the wasteful production of photons. Instead, that transfer of excitation, that transfer of energy via excitation, is called resonance energy transfer. And how that happens is also beyond the scope of this course, but you just have to take my word for it that it happens. And if you really want to look at the details, you can look it up. But we're talking about quantum physics. This is not a quantum physics course. So resonance energy transfer is represented in this cartoon by these black arrows. This is the only one receiving a photon to get excited. This one gets excited because the first excited chlorophyll excites it. And so on. It will then excite its neighbor. That's the bouncing around of the black arrows. Eventually, in the excitation via resonance energy transfer reaches this special pair of chlorophyll A's in the reaction center complex, the middle of the photosystem. And that's a special pair that, when it does get excited, gets especially excited. It has a special arrangement between these pairs so that if when it gets excited, not only does an electron go up, away from the, excited means farther away from the nucleus, right? This electron gets so excited that it completely leaves the molecule, the chlorophyll. That's represented by the orange arrow with the E minus in it, the electron. So this electron doesn't just stick to this in a higher level, it gets totally lost. Now the electron is still there, of course, it's just no longer part of this excited chlorophyll. It immediately gets snatched up by another component of the reaction center complex called, descriptively enough, the primary electron acceptor. Now think about chemically what is happening here. What is happening to the primary electron acceptor? All you have to do is read its name to know what's happening to it. It's becoming reduced, exactly. This is a redox reaction driven by light. The primary electron acceptor becomes reduced. because it's willing to take on the electron that comes from the excited chlorophyll pair. Well, what do you know about reduced materials from the previous chapter?
Got less energy?
More energy. The reduced form is the full taxi. The electrons that the full taxi is carrying is energy. Okay? So in other words, this primary electron acceptor gets an energy investment when it receives the electron. It is now carrying energy that used to be in the light. But now it's in chemical form, in the form of a reduced compound. Just like NADH is carrying energy that used to be in the fuel in the previous chapter. Okay? Reduced compounds carry energy. And therefore, just like NADH is useful stuff because it is carrying that energy, so is the reduced version of the primary electron acceptor. As long as it delivers it properly, right? The taxis, the NADH has had to deliver those electrons to electron transport chains in order for that to pay off, right? Well, we're going to see that very similar thing happens here. But I'm going to stop there because I don't have time to start the next slide. This is the transduction step, though. The energy gets transduced, in other words, changed from one form to another, from light energy, electromagnetic radiation, to the energy of a reduced compound.